exactly what we're looking for. I wanted to ask you some more about what we were talking about, this book. Where did the idea originate?
Well, of course, it was after it was going to be written in memory of Willard Dowell. And Ray Boyer and Ray Boundy, I would say, were the key people who thought that this would be a good way to do the good thing to do.
Was company approval needed along the way?
Well, of course, Boundy was director of research, director of corporate research, so. So he had the power to do it. See, oh, there were people who criticized it, but nevertheless, and of course Boyer at that time was also serving in that research triumvirate.
Oh, yes, yes.
So you know he was he had a lot of impact. People listened to Ray. Ray was, I think, of all the people that I've ever met in industrial science, Ray was the greatest champion of basic research that I've known. Mm. He really honestly believed that studying and understanding fundamental science was the way a company could really grow very solidly.
Of course, H.H. Dow also.
Well, I never knew old H.H. because he died in 1932, you know. But yes, I've read, of course, the biographies that have been written on him, and he would have been very much along that line. In fact, I really think that it was Boyer's reading on old H.H. and the research philosophies that he had that influenced Ray. I know that. That certainly Boyer's beliefs influenced me tremendously in the way I approach problems throughout my entire research career.
Well, he evidently supported you very strongly as you developed from a 20-year-old lab tech into a research scientist.
Here's something funny, you know. I probably shouldn't even bring this out, but I'll show you something. I was. This is something that shouldn't be public. So, I just sued you. Turn off your speaker.
One of the things that we had talked about, I think even before we started taping, you know, you were looking at the transcript of Ray's, was the high-impact polystyrene.
Mm-hmm.
Could we go back and talk about that a little bit in terms of Ray did the first. That he did the first experiments. You did the first experiments.
Well, you have that report. You got that report there. It's you notice there's several things in here. For example, the Dr. Beebe obtained several pounds of soluble BNS rubber from the University of Akron. Agents for rubber reserve for the purpose of preparing these compositions with styrene. Now that was what we had talked about. See, a lot of it goes back. It was not the whole development was not a off the cuff type of thing. In fact, the matter is when Ray came to me one day, and this was just a few years ago, he said, "How in the world did we get going on that?" I said, "Well." I said, our polystyrene was brittle as all hell, as you remember, at that time. And we were looking, first of all, at all sorts of low molecular weight plasticizers. There were materials, you know, like polynuclear aromatics and polyalkyl benzenes and all that softened polystyrene but never enhanced toughness properties. It just simply dropped the glass transition. I said, about the only lead that we had was that the old Ostermaslinsky patent that he had put rubber into styrene and claimed to have got a tough horny material. And then I said, the next thing is we had this work where we'd done in the Paraplex X100 casting systems where we had found it indeed a polyester type of additive copolymerized with styrene gave us very tough castings. But I said, then we realized that we had always this insoluble gel. We didn't know how it originated, but we kept looking for something that would give us impact properties and, you know, moldability at the same time instead of such a cross-linked network. And so the point was that we had looked at Bobby Dreisbach's rubber that was a methyl isopropanol ketone and butadiene rubber. We looked at all sorts of natural rubber, or deprotonized rubber and everything else, you know, that was available. And we had looked at the even some of the early butadiene styrene rubbers. We looked at straight polybutadiene. It was made in bulk. All of these things, put them into styrene, they'd all swell, but none of them dissolved. And I said, so really what had been the lead that we might be able to make something that was moldable was that business of taking, putting the old dodecamercaptan into the formulation. As it finally dawned on someone, you know, that that you could probably get away from making extremely high molecular weight rubber. You know, during the war, if you go back and were to, and you may have information on this too, I'm sure, but the GRS really came from Germany. The Germans tried in the 30s to teach companies in this country to make styrene butadiene rubber. And the British had and the Dutch had the neat monopoly on natural rubber. So every time someone looked like they were a little bit interested, they'd just drop that price like a yo-yo. And when the interest subsided, they'd bring it back up again. So you look at the wild fluctuations in price of natural rubber through from the 20s to 1940, and you realize just how well those people managed that. OPEC could take good lessons from it. But the point was that when the decision was made to go and make GRS, the emulsion formulations that people worked on, you know, gave polymers that were so high molecular weight that they were practically intractable. And they couldn't break it down on the rubber mills like they did the regular natural rubber. So the first polymers that I remember, they were throwing a lot of tall oil and everything else into it, you know, and just to get enough plasticity to be able to handle it. And the tires that they made would run about 2,000-3,000 miles and disintegrate. So at any rate, I think it was, 1937, isn't it, that Mayo came along with the chain transfer and chain stopper ideas. But it took a couple of years after they were manufacturing GRS, I think, before they started adding dodecamercaptan and getting the soluble, completely soluble GRS. See? And that's really wasn't the idea that you were going to be able to make anything that was a lot better, at least. But we felt that we would make something a lot more homogeneous, because you'd get to see. The funny thing was, with some of that early rubber that you put it into styrene, polybutadiene, you'd end up getting a heterogeneous mixture, and if you were lucky to get the right piece out of the polymer, it felt tough. You could hit it, and the impact was obviously improved, but we didn't know of any way to make it consistent, and so that just seemed like a good idea. It turned out, of course, then, that what we did, as soon as this was done, Steve said solutions with soluble Bunerest rubber were prepared with up to 20% rubber and styrene. However, it was very difficult to get a homogeneous solution which was pourable at room temperature with more than 10 to 12% of the rubber. For this reason, work described herein was limited to concentrations of 10% rubber and styrene. We used benzoyl peroxide and 1 1/4 inch diameter, 1 foot long seal bombs. Polymerized 8 days at 60, 2 at 80, and 2 at 120. After this, sample were allowed to cool slowly, removed from the bombs, and turned over to Ray McIntyre for molding and physical test in the polymer. And so from there on, Ray McIntyre and Leo Kinn continued the work. But what we did find on this that was rather interesting to us was that unlike the plasticizers, which lowered TG, see, Ray Boyer had built a heat distortion apparatus at the time, and you undoubtedly have run into that, and it was nothing more than a device that would take 2-inch-long samples, a half-inch wide, and 1/8 of an inch thick, and load them on the center, and then you could heat at a constant temperature rate until you got 5 mils deflection, and that was the point where we took it as the heat distortion. So, looking at these samples, we varied our soluble rubber in increments up to 10%, and used constant peroxide. But then, when looking at flat impact, which of course you'd say, well, that isn't a very good impact measurement, but that's what the hell we had. We had Izar flat impact. And you notice that, you know, by the time we're getting up even to 1%, we're showing quite an improvement. 5% rubber looks pretty good, and the 10% was. But the point was that you notice that at 5% yet, our heat distortion values were still all staying up. Our tensils were hanging fairly constant, but at 10% we started to get the drop in heat distortion. And so that's really was, what we were shooting at. Of course, always back at those times, we used to look at the dielectric constant and the loss factors of these things because that was a key interest. But that's the way that it went. And after this initial piece of work, I don't think I touched anything on impact enhancement of polystyrene until about 1949, and I did a lot of work on trying to establish that these were branch structures and so forth, but still there was no real realization of the morphology of the rubber modified polymer until, at least in our company, nobody realized it until Gunther Molau really did the electron microscopy of looked at the osmium stained cross section and identified the fact that it was indeed a continuum of polystyrene with the rubber particles. It also had inclusions of polystyrene in that matrix. But when he found that out, all of a sudden, this is where the first realization came that our competitors were using the Amos patent to make the bomb. But it was, that's 10 years after the patent's issued. And I dare say, if Dow had known that ahead of time and had gone to these companies, that they would have been able to make an equitable settlement. As it was, you go after 10 years and you say, well, you must owe me about $50 to $75 million in back royalties. Never going to get it. So, but that's kind of at least the story that I see. I felt that Amos's discovery really was a true discovery, a true patent. There wasn't any precedent to tell you that that if you polymerized rubber in styrene and had an agitated system, that you were going to get a phase inversion and it was going to work that way. Fact of the matter is here, there was no phase inversion, but there's impact properties. And if you look at the microscopy of this stuff, what you find is that it's almost like a three-dimensional fishnet in there, where the rubber phase is a continuum, and the polystyrene in between it is a discontinuous phase. So this is not exactly the same thing that we think of today as the morphology of an AVS or of impact polystyrene.
How rapidly did you move through those five ranks that you indicated earlier?
Well, there was a timetable that there was a minimum timetable that you had to follow. But I think that I managed to convince them that I should have all the tests within, I think, about 4.5 years or something like that. I went right through that. But then when Willard Dow he had some ideas and some things that he wanted to work on, some chemistry that he wanted to work on, and he had called our lab management and said to shift me over to a salaried position, and that was about 1945, I think, 45, 46, something like that.
Okay, I had 1946, kind of chemist.
And then of course I went through project leader, group leader, lab group leader, and then I had the opportunity at that point it was around the mid-50s to become a division leader in what was the polymer division at that time. And they ran it, they ran the lab. It was probably about 120, 130 people at that point, and they had an engineering division and an inorganic chemistry division, a polymer division, and so forth, and foams division by that time. And so I had the opportunity to go that way. But also, that's about the time that Boundy announced the dual ranks, the opportunity to be professional scientist or to go into management. And so I turned down the management opportunity. I said I'd go the other way. Most people said I was crazy with my educational level, that would be reserved for PhDs. As it turned out, it wasn't, because at 57 I had the associate scientist rank, and 67 I had the research scientist. In my work record, it's interesting, because there's one day in there where I was presumably something else when things got shifted around in the company, but that really was nothing. It was not something that was actually done. It just shows up as something that as a change that was made. I don't know whether I became a development engineer or something like that for 24 hours or what, but that was the way it went.
When you made the choice to stay in research versus management, what was the general feeling about the other people who had to make that choice?
Oh, gosh, there weren't very many at that point. Of course, I remember reading Ray Boundy's summary on what was expected of the people who followed the professional ranks, what their responsibilities would be, and so forth. But there were not too many that were making that choice, were consciously making that choice at the time. But there were folks like, Ralph Wiley and so forth, and of course Turner Alfrey, and that never did go through the associate scientist, but a number of other people did. And it turned out, really, if you go back and look in the history of Dow, that very few people we accepted the and wanted to go to the professional ranks at the time and went to and became associate scientist, ever made research scientist. I dare say that out of there probably wasn't one in ten who went the professional route and took associate scientist that ever moved on it.
That's interesting. Is there still such an arrangement today?
Yeah, it's still the... Now, Boundy's perspective of it was that when that type of classifications were fully developed in the mature company, that there probably would be about 100 people in the associate scientist rank, and there would be somewhere around 25 in the research scientist rank. And it holds fairly close to that, I think, today. But I felt it was a good way to go. For me, I really couldn't conceive of any other way, I guess, because I kind of felt that the things that turned me on most, I was seeing in the laboratory, and I could see the less attractive, at least to me, areas of management that... So I guess I felt I did the right thing.
That was about 52, did you say?
Well, I think that it was 50, about 52 I was a lab group leader. It was around 54 or 55 that I had the opportunity to move up in research management.
I see.
But it was 50, you know, it took, from the time I made a decision to go the other route, I think it was maybe a year and a half before I was promoted over into that category.
Let me back up for a moment. Something you had mentioned earlier I didn't follow up on. You said that Willard Dow was responsible for moving you to a salaried position because he had certain things he wanted you to do. What did he ask you to do?
Well, this is kind of an offbeat story, but it goes back to some work that was being done by one of the fellows in the physics lab in the 40s. He became interested in chemotherapy of cancer, and there were some ideas on the oxidation reduction systems that you could look at. For example, the ascorbic and dehydroascorbic acid systems, the inositol and rhodazonic acid triquinolyl systems of that kind. And I had been working on compounds of that type really because of my interest in free radical inhibitors and antioxidants. So it turned out that I had gotten together with this fellow, and he was getting mice from Bar Harbor, you know, and I was synthesizing compounds that, in fact, as I'd oxidized TBC to the corresponding quinone and so forth. He'd take these compounds and make ointments out of them and topically apply them to the tumors on these mice. At that, you know, Bar Harbor was producing strains of mice at that time that you could predict almost to the day in their lifetime when they were going to develop a tumor. So researchers around the country at that time were trying to, of course, find answers to, chemical answers to how you could treat cancer, and the mice were the animals of choice. So Jim Sheridan had done a lot of work on on trying. Jim was getting some statistically significant results. Well, then at that time also, there was an individual who had been, he was a medical doctor. He had been a professor at the University of Michigan, as far as I knew. And he had come up with some similar types of compounds that that he was giving to people experimentally to try to that it's very primitive work on chemotherapy. This fellow's name was Bill Koch, and he came under very severe criticism for the type of work that he did by the American Medical Society. And, of course, he got virtually no support from them, and he had left the University of Michigan, so he was on his own. So he came up here and somehow got acquainted with Willard Dowsey. So the question of him being able to continue some work and to have somebody who we might interact with at Dow came up, and Willard Dow, knowing about Sheridan's work, got him involved with him, and Sheridan also mentioned that I was making these compounds for him, and so Willard had met me, and so he said, well, let's get him to work too. Well, that whole period of time became so controversial in that, because the Food and Drug was very much opposed to Koch continuing to do the kind of thing that he did. He was taking generally terminal cancer patients and working with them. I suppose in a lot of respects, if it had been dignified by the AMA approving it, it would have been fine. But as it was, Koch was not all that much supported by the AMA. So this went on for a couple of years that we made compounds that were tested. I tried to get them to build a cancer research laboratory in Midland here to be able to do screening work and do a lot of that type of chemistry. And I don't know whether the Koch was afraid that the compounds that he was pushing would be shown that they didn't work or what, but it was a thing that I went ahead and did. I synthesized a lot of those compounds for him at the time, and then of course finally this federal trial with Koch ended as a hung jury, and Koch left the country. So. And at about the same time, Willard was killed. And the rest of the Dow management at that time didn't want to get involved in it. So they said that I should terminate any work in that area.
How long a period of time were you involved in that?
Oh, from about 1945 to 1949.
Did you